Welcome to this deep dive. Today we're tackling a really interesting question about property law, specifically how shared rights affect property taxes. By looking at the 1982 New Hampshire Supreme Court case, Waterville Estates Association v. Town of Campden.
Yeah, this one's a classic. We've got all the key details, the arguments, how the court landed.
Right, and our mission. To figure out if giving condo owners shared access to amenities, you know, like a ski lodge or a pool, actually lowers the taxable value of that common property.
Exactly. So the scene is Waterville Estates. It's a condo development. Owners get to use common areas, recreational facilities, that sort of thing. And the town, Campden, hits these common areas with a tax bill, $76,000.
But the homeowners association pushes back, arguing, hey, because everyone has the right to use this land, it's practically valueless on its own.
And it wasn't just talk. It went to trial court. And the judge actually agreed with the homeowners, dropped that 76 grand valuation down to just $100.
$100. I mean, you can imagine, the town wasn't thrilled. That massive difference. That's what kicked it up to the New Hampshire Supreme Court.
Which brings us right to the core legal question, you know, for you law students listening. Were these shared rights actual easements, like substantial property interests, or were they just licenses, more like temporary permission slips?
Because that classification, easement versus license, that would totally change how much these rights impacted the taxable value, right?
Precisely.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit. The developer of Waterville Estates, they recorded this declaration giving each owner rights to the common areas. They even used fancy terms like equitable servitudes that would run with the land.
Meaning intended to be permanent, tied to owning the condo itself.
Exactly. But here's the kicker, the really interesting part. The declaration also said these rights could be revoked if 2/3 of the homeowners association voted for it.
And that little detail, that potential revocation, becomes absolutely crucial. So back in 1979, Campden slaps on that $76,000 tax. The Waterville States Association immediately sues for a tax abatement, basically a tax break.
Their argument being these shared rights were like burdensome easements, really dragging down the value of the common land for any other separate use.
And like we said, the trial court bought it, hence the almost zero, well, $100 valuation. But Campden appeals. They argue, no, these aren't permanent easements that lower value. They're revocable licenses.
Like temporary permission that can just be yanked away.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't tank the tax assessment.
So the New Hampshire Supreme Court gets the case and they have to figure out, was the trial court right? Can you treat these potentially revocable rights as if they were permanent easements when you're calculating property tax?
Right. So you've got the two camps. The association says these are easements of pertinent. And for those brushing up on property terms, that means they're written, intended to be permanent, and directly benefit the individual condos, the dominant estates.
Uh-huh. And because of that, they argued, these rights severely limit what else you can do with the common property, crushing its market value.
But Campden's saying, hold on, they can be revoked. That possibility, that lack of absolute permanence, means they're just licenses.
And licenses generally are temporary personal permissions. They don't usually stick to the land in the same way or impact its value long term.
So it's really vital, isn't it, to understand why this distinction matters so much for the bottom line?
Oh, absolutely. Easements, because they are actual interests in the property, can definitely lower its market value. If someone has a permanent right-of-way across your backyard, your property might be worth less, right?
Makes sense.
Licenses, though, usually don't have that same kind of weight in evaluation.
Okay, so let's dig into the association side more. Why did they think these rights were more like easements, despite the revocation clause?
Well, they hit a few key points. First, formality. These rights weren't just handshake deals. They were formally recorded in the property records. That gives them a certain gravity, puts everyone on notice.
Recording is always important in property law.
Definitely. Second, the benefit. They stress that these rights directly benefited the individual condos, the dominant estates. Owning a condo was better because you had the right to use the pool, the lodge. It enhanced the value of the condo itself.
So the right wasn't just personal to the owner, it was tied to the property.
Exactly. And finally, they pointed to that 2/3 vote requirement for revocation. They argued that needing such a high supermajority vote meant these rights weren't easily extinguishable. It suggested a significant degree of intended permanence.
Okay, that lays out their case pretty well. What was Campden's counterpunch? How did they keep hammering the license angle?
Campden really just doubled down on the revocation possibility. Their logic was straightforward. If it can be taken away, even by a supermajority, it fundamentally lacks the permanence of a true easement.
Easements are supposed to be lasting, right?
Generally, yes. Mm-hmm. That's the traditional view. So Campton argued that the mere possibility of these rights disappearing meant they were inherently temporary, like licenses.
Okay, crystal clear arguments on both sides. Yeah. So, drum roll. What did the New Hampshire Supreme Court decide? Who won?
The homeowners. The New Hampshire Supreme Court sided with the Waterville Estates Association. They agreed that these shared rights did effectively reduce the taxable value of the common property.
Wow. So they upheld the lower valuation.
Yeah.
What was the core of their reasoning?
Mm-hmm.
Justice Bois wrote the opinion, right? What did he say?
Yeah, Justice Bois wrote it. He acknowledged up front that these rights didn't fit the perfect traditional definition of an easement, mainly because of that revocation clause.
Okay, so he saw the town's point there.
He did. But he said, look at the characteristics they do have. They were in writing, formally documented. They were clearly intended to benefit the land itself, to run with the land, making owning a condo there more valuable. And crucially, they served a dominant estate, the individual condos. They had a lot of the hallmarks of an easement.
Interesting. So function over form, almost. But what about the revocation? That seems like a big hurdle to just calling them easement-like.
Right. That was the key issue the court had to grapple with. And Justice Waugh had a really clever response. He said, look, just because they can be revoked doesn't automatically make them mere licenses.
How did he justify that?
He drew an analogy to mutual easements. Think about, say, two neighbors who share a driveway under a formal easement agreement. Those mutual easements can often be terminated too, right? If both neighbors agree to end the arrangement.
Ah, okay. So even some traditional easements aren't absolutely permanent forever under all circumstances.
Exactly. So the court reasoned that the two-thirds vote requirement in Waterville was actually a significant barrier to revocation. It wasn't like one person could just change their mind. It showed a substantial degree of stability and intended permanence, much more than a simple, easily revocable license.
That comparison to mutual easements really helps make sense of it. It reframes the revocability, doesn't it?
It does. It suggests that permanence in property law might be more of a spectrum than an absolute on-off switch. The court was looking at the practical reality. Were these rights flimsy and easily canceled, or did they represent a significant lasting burden on the common land? They concluded it was the latter.
Now, didn't the town also raise concerns about, like, a slippery slope, worrying this would open the floodgates for tax avoidance?
They absolutely did. Campton argued this could let any homeowners association just create flimsy rights to slash their common area taxes, but the court specifically addressed that fear.
And shut it down.
Pretty much. Justice Boyd was clear. This ruling is narrow. It's based on the specific facts, the specific recorded declaration, the two-thirds vote requirement in this case. They weren't creating a blank check for tax evasion.
Good to clarify. So, boiling it down, what's the absolute core principle we should take away from the court's analysis here?
The fundamental takeaway is this. If a right associated with a property functions like an easement, if it looks like an easement in how it burdens the land and benefits other land, then it can reduce the property's taxable value even if there's a mechanism for revocation.
So the label isn't everything. The effect matters.
Precisely. The court looked beyond the strict legal category and focused on the practical impact of these rights on the common property's usability and marketability.
It feels like a very pragmatic approach, less caught up in rigid definitions.
I think that's fair. They weren't inventing new law, but they were applying existing principles flexibly to a modern ownership structure, the condo development, which didn't perfectly fit the old feudal land categories.
Okay, so just to confirm the final outcome then.
The Supreme Court upheld the trial court's decision. That $100 valuation for the common areas stood.
A huge win for the association. Now, zooming out, why is this 1982 case still important? Why should a law student today, you know, pay attention to it?
It provides really important clarification, especially at the intersection of property law and taxation. It establishes that even rights that aren't technically permanent easements in the strictest sense can still legally encumber a property enough to justify lowering its taxable value.
So tax assessors can't just look at the title.
No, they have to consider the whole bundle of rights and restrictions affecting the property's use and value. This case shows that even seemingly complex or conditional rights matter.
And for the law students specifically listening, what's the key lesson here?
I think the big lesson is seeing how these formal legal concepts you learn, easement, license, dominant estate, servient estate, have very real practical economic consequences. And Waterville Estates shows courts wrestling with applying these concepts to new situations, sometimes emphasizing practical effect over rigid definitions. It's about how law adapts.
And it definitely seems relevant today with condos and HOAs everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. The legal structures underpinning shared amenities and developments today often draw on principles debated in cases like this. Understanding Waterville Estates helps you understand the basis for how those rights and burdens are treated for tax purposes.
Okay, so wrapping this up, the Waterville Estates case really drives home that a property's taxable value isn't just about the dirt and the buildings. It's deeply tied to the legal rights and restrictions attached to it.
Yeah, and even shared rights that might seem less than permanent, because they can be revoked, can still pack a major financial punch when it comes to taxes.
It definitely makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, how has this influenced tax assessments for common areas since then? And what should developers or HOAs think about when they're drafting these documents?
Those are great questions. And maybe one final thought to leave people with. Given the court's focus on how these revocable rights function like easements, does this case signal a sort of ongoing evolution in property law? Is the law becoming more flexible to handle these increasingly complex ways we own and share property?
Definitely something to chew on. Thanks for diving deep with us today.